to the main event. Let's get ready to rumble!
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network. And this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. Terrible Tommy here in the bunker right here in north central Indiana. Right. Beautiful day. It's snow's all melting away and the sun's out and it's going to be nice. It's supposed to get even warmer here today. So I'm going to get my thong out here so I can put my inner tube down in the creek down here and have a good swim later. But it's not quite warm enough yet. Yeah. Okay, let's see here. Now, this is the 19th, I believe. Yeah, it's February the 19th, 2016. And I got a hell of a story for you here right off the bat. For all you Trumpites out there, all you Trumpies, you're all excited about Trump. I told you so. I told you so. Yeah, here we go.
Speaking to Sean Hannity on Fox News Thursday night, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump said, Hannity said, Israel is our number one ally in the region, and that alliance has been, well, fractured. Trump responded, Israel is so important. What Obama has done to Israel is a disgrace. How they even talk to us is hard to believe. How do they talk to Obama? You know, I have friends who support Obama, I said, how do you do it? It's almost like they do it out of habit. They agree he's been terrible. You look at what he's done to Israel, with just this Iran deal, which is such a terrible deal. He's been the worst thing that's ever happened to Israel. Now, a lot of my friends that are Jewish do not support him any longer. But I still have some that do. I say, how can you do it? Hannity commented, he's been horrible to Israel. Trump said, you know what? I think it's habit. They do it out of habit. The data confirm Trump's notion. In 2008, U.S. Jews voted in droves for Barack Obama, 78-22 over Republican John McCain. That trend has shifted somewhat in 2012, when the vote was 69-30 for Obama over Mitt Romney. The only time in recent history Jews split their vote almost evenly was in 1980, when they gave incumbent Jimmy Carter only 45% of their vote, versus 39% to Ronald Reagan.
Well, boys and girls, I just sent you a file of several articles on the militia, outcome of the militia situation up there in Oregon. It's not pretty. And, of course, if you've been watching this stuff like I've been watching it over years, you know it wasn't going to end well. So I sent you those articles, and now I'm going to send you an audio description of some of the things going on there.
Shauna Cox, a key figure in the Oregon militia standoff who is accused of conspiring against the government, says she suffered damages from the works of the devil and wants federal officials to award her $666 billion. Cox, a 59-year-old Kanab, Utah woman facing federal charges for her role in the armed occupation of a wildlife refuge, has filed a counter-criminal complaint against federal employees seeking $666 billion, $666 million, $666,000, $666.66. Cox is one of two women in the group of 25 people that federal authorities have charged in connection with the occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge that began January 2 and ended last week after a dramatic standoff with the FBI. The Utah anti-government activist, who officials say was an important leader and spokeswoman for the Oregon militia, is also one of the few defendants who was permitted to return home on house arrest as the case moves forward. Most of the arrested right-wing protesters, including occupation leader Ammon Bundy, remain in jail. Cox has apparently used her free time to write up an 8-page countersuit that includes rants about government corruption and abuse, naming many of the central, federal and local Harney County officials involved in the arrest and prosecution of the protesters. "I came to the assistance of economically vulnerable individuals who were being harassed, threatened, intimidated, persecuted, and incarcerated by arrogant, narcissi federal government officials who have organized together to hijack and steal our constitutional form of government from the people of the United States of America, sick," she wrote in the complaint filed Wednesday. She also discusses ranchers Dwight and Stephen Hammond, the Oregon father and son whose imprisonment inspired the standoff, and wrote at length about the death of Lavoy Finicum, the occupation spokesman who Oregon State Police officers shot and killed when they attempted to arrest him outside of the refuge occupation last month. Cox was in the car with Finicum before he was killed, and she was arrested soon after. "State and federal employees organized together to attempt to murder me and they executed Lavoy Finicum, to terrorize the people of the United States of America so they could continue to socialize and communize the United States of America, and continue to use their state and federal bar licenses to steal the lives, liberties, and properties of economically vulnerable individuals," Cox wrote. "The occupation of the federal buildings was a legal way to challenge the government," she further argued. Cox also listed dozens of criminal offenses that she alleges were committed against her and the other protesters, adding up to damages in excess of $666,666,666,666.66. Cox did not immediately respond to requests for comment Thursday morning. A spokesperson for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Oregon also did not respond to a request for comment.
Well, I guess part of these people up there were the delusional Christ insanity people, the gal raving on about the devil. Oh, these people were the people we're fighting are worse than any imaginary spook devil, I'll tell you that. But what the thing they don't seem to understand is when they say communism, socialism, they seem to try to lighten the burden by saying that, because it's actually communism and Jewish socialism has always been used by the ruling class, the predatory capitalists, to beat us over the head. And these guys in the conservative type and right-wing groups don't seem to understand that. Or if they do understand it, they don't talk about it. They think that the public will respond if you say, "Well, I'm fighting communism." Well, look, I spent 30, 40 years fighting communism, and I didn't get much out of it, and I spent a lot of money doing it. So anyhow, that's... what you're fighting is at the top. It's just like when you say you're fighting the Anti-Defamation League. You know, what you really should be fighting is the B'nai B'rith, which is the brains and guts of this Jewish Zionist cabal. The ADL is simply an investigating arm of the B'nai B'rith. You hardly ever hear right-wingers talking about the B'nai B'rith, an international Masonic-style control organization. And you never hear too much of right-wing conservatives talking about predatory capitalism, because the right wing has been infused over the decades with the, you know, "We're capitalists." Well, they get free enterprise and capitalism mixed up. If you're a free enterpriser, that's good. If you're a capitalist, that's bad. So there's a difference. And get it straight before more and more of you get hauled away to the clink. And waging war against the Mickey Mousers at the bottom of the heap is a waste of time, and then you end up a lot of times waging war against your neighbors who don't know shit, and you don't get any place. It's delusion, and delusion will get you nowhere. You gotta identify the people at the top, who they are, what they're doing, and why they are the enemy. Just like when we ID George Bush and Cheney and these kind of people as the enemy because they're warmongers and they're tools of the predatory capitalists. And that's where you have to fight, not at the bottom. Like I always say, boys and girls, follow the money. And where the most money's at, you're going to find your enemies at. Well, let's check in on the Pessimist's Guide to History again this morning. I'm sure we can find some real tragedies here for you. 1811, 2,000 British sailors die in the storms. A flotilla of British warships returning to England from duty in the Baltic were battered by a series of storms. Both the St. George and the Defense sank off the English coast, taking some 2,000 men to the bottom with them. Strangely, parts of the ship's broken hulls came back up to the surface sometime later, with the bodies of hundreds of dead soldiers strewn on the decks. They didn't lie full fathom five in this tempest. 1811, 1812. New Madrid earthquakes. A group of French settlers dancing at a lively party were probably the only people still awake in New Madrid, Missouri, late one night on December the 15th. Flat-bottomed barges on their way downriver to New Orleans were moored as usual for the night, tied to trees on islands and along the banks of the Mississippi River. Suddenly, the whole area was rocked by a massive earthquake, the strongest in the United States up until that time. One observer recalled an enormous noise like a loud thunder, followed instantly by deafening squawks of thousands of geese and other wild birds that, terrorized by the chaos, landed in large numbers on the boats moored along the river. Some birds even landed on the heads and shoulders of the frightened people on board the boats. Bright flashes of light illuminated the darkened sky. The residents raced out of their homes in fear as their houses collapsed. Trees swayed and trembled, and the ground sank under them. Fissures began to open in the ground, causing huge trees to break and fall. The swallowing and swallowing dwellings and people alike. Enormous chunks of the riverbank rumbled into the Mississippi. In one area, the entire graveyard slid down into the Mississippi. The river churned and boiled with a violent shaking of the earth, while the waves lashed at the shore, sinking many of the boats moored there. A young boy who was watching the terrible turmoil recalled that the land itself seemed to be moving in huge waves. The 90-square-mile real-foot lake in northwest Tennessee was created in a matter of minutes that night. The bottom of the swamp simply dropped, and the water from a nearby creek rushed in to fill it. Elsewhere, earth, water, mud, rocks, and chunks of dirt blew straight up into the air with amazing force. Although several towns near New Madrid were completely leveled by the earthquake, there were surprisingly few casualties, partly because so many people in the area lived in log cabins, which withstood a lot of shaking. Architects take heed. But the calamity was hardly over. Some people said that throughout that fateful winter, the land hardly ever seemed to be at rest. For almost 2 months, the region was repeatedly shaken with shocks and quakes. One resident counted 1,874 shocks between December 16, 1811 and February 7, 1812, when the deadliest one of all occurred. This time, the town of New Madrid was completely destroyed. The massive commotion of the earth shook the Mississippis and reverbed so violently that two new waterfalls were created where none had been before. For hundreds of miles, the river flowed backwards for a time. Presumably, part of the reverbed had been lifted high enough to send the water running northward instead of the south. The devastating earthquakes that plagued New Madrid were felt over an area of 1.5 million square miles, nearly half the area of the continent of the United States. In Washington, D.C., windows and chandeliers rattled ominously, while in Charleston, South Carolina, the quake rang church bells. Now, that was a pretty big one, boys and girls. See, we're pretty, you know, we've had it pretty cool for a long time. Nothing really bad. So thank your lucky spooks. Well, that's pretty exciting. Let's go on and read some more here. 1812, earthquake destroys Caracas, Venezuela. Many citizens in Caracas were in church. He should have been in a bar on March 12th, because God doesn't destroy bars, he destroys churches. On March 26th, Holy Thursday, without warning, a massive earthquake struck the city. Its tremors collapsed three churches into the penitent masses and killing everyone inside. But no bars, no taverns were destroyed. 15-foot-thick columns supporting one of the churches, yet they could not withstand the quake. Scores of troops were killed when a giant fissure opened up and swallowed their barracks. Within minutes, 90% of Caracas lay in ruins, and thousands of people were trapped and screaming for help from within the city's homes, churches, and other buildings, but not the bars. Rescuers freed some 2,000 trapped survivors, but 15,000 people were killed in the city and the surrounding area. In the quake's aftermath, famine and disease killed another 5,000 people. There you go. It's not nice to fool Mother Nature. 1812, Moscow burns. From the hills outside Moscow on September 12th, the French Emperor Napoleon gazed with satisfaction on the beautiful, ornate city below him. Napoleon believed the conquest of Moscow would bring about the surrender of Russia, making it the greatest victory yet. But disturbing reports began to reach the emperor. Sentries brought news of the entire city of 2,500 appearing to be almost completely deserted. Moscow deserted? A most likely event, Napoleon declared. Most unlikely event. 2 days later, the French troops entered the evacuated city, and Napoleon set up headquarters inside the massive palace of the Kremlin. That did nothing to stop the disturbing reports, however. Fires were breaking out all over the deserted city. At first, Napoleon blamed them on accidents or on looting by his own troops. But the fires broke out anew every time the French put them out. Soon the truth became apparent. The Russians had released prisoners and ordered them to burn the city. Count Rostopchin, governor of Moscow, posted a notice to Napoleon on his palace. Quote, I set fire to my house that it may not be polluted by your presence, unquote. Napoleon stared at the spreading flames from his vantage point in the Kremlin, could not believe the Russians would burn their greatest city. Quote, what a people, he explained. Quote, the barbarians, such terrible tactics have no precedent in history of civilization. A demon inspires these people. Soon the fires were burning in every part of the city. They spread from house to house, filling the air with black smoke. Canopies of fire covered whole streets as gale force winds whipped the flames still higher. One French witness said the city looked like a volcano with many craters. Surrounded by flames in the Kremlin, Napoleon still clung to the hope of victory. Late that night, by the light of the blazing city, he wrote a letter to Tsar Alexander demanding Russia's surrender. But soon the Kremlin itself was burning. Napoleon watched the fire through the windows that were too hot to touch. Finally, the flames forced Napoleon to give up his prize and flee with his guard through the burning streets. Count Philippe de Seguir described Napoleon's evacuation, quote, "Only one way was open, a narrow, winding street already afire from one end to the other, which seemed more like an entrance into hell than an escape from it." But the emperor, without hesitation, rushed this dangerous passage and forced his way ahead in the roar of the crackling flames, the crash of floors and ceilings, the fall of burning beams, and the red-hot sheets of iron roofing. We were walking on floor of fire, under a sky of fire, between the walls of fire. Quote, "The fires went on for 6 days and nights," one witness wrote, "so it was impossible to tell night from day. While Napoleon waited outside the city, many of his soldiers risked the flames to loot the burning city. Many died when buildings collapsed on top of them." Meanwhile, Napoleon ordered the execution of anyone suspected of starting the fires. One officer described how at every step one trod on dead or scorched people, and the corpses of incendiaries hung from many half-burnt trees. Rain fell on September 18th, gradually extinguishing the blaze. By that time, nine-tenths of the once great city had been destroyed. Only about 2,300 houses still stood, and half of its 2,000 churches were burned to the ground. Staring at the ruined city on September 18th, Napoleon muttered, quote, "This presages great misfortunes for us." A month later, the first snows began, and Napoleon denied both winter quarters and a major source of supplies for his great army, began his disastrous retreat from Russia. And it wasn't to the strains of Tchaikovsky's 1812 overture. What price, glory? And also remember, by the time Napoleon reached Paris in the retreat from Moscow, he only had one man with him, and he had left with many thousands of troops. There's a lesson in that story, a lesson. People who are willing to give it all up for victory, in the end, will win. Well, I don't know whether you've seen it yet, but remember what I told you about Scalia, the Supreme Court justice that just died? You got to check it out, because now it's come out that in the morning, when this fellow went in the bedroom, Scalia's bedroom, there was a pillow on his face. Yeah, there was a pillow on his face. So there's getting to be quite a few questions about that, just like I inherently knew that anytime some powerful person like that is in charge of making rules and so forth on many things, bites the dust mysteriously, you better check it out. And there's more coming out on this all the time. More coming out all the time. Maybe not. Maybe. Now, somebody has said that this Loretta Lynch is very likely to be presented to be made one of the Supreme Court justices. She's a real Obama person, so we'll see how that goes. Well, looks like the Mormon Church, for some reason, up there in Utah, has helps squelch the drive for hate crimes laws in Utah, which is a little bit different than most churches. So let's check in on this.
Considered a death blow to the effort by supporters. Considered a death blow to the effort by supporters.
There was no reply to an email to the church on Thursday seeking a response to the statements by IRCWR and supporters, including a prosecutor and representatives of several other faiths, at a fiery news conference. This is Utah. We know what happens when the LDS Church makes a statement about legislation. It does alter the course of the bill. That is the political reality of Utah, said Troy Williams, the executive director of the gay rights group Equality Utah. Most Utah legislators are members of the faith, as are about 60% of state residents. The church's political sway was evident last year when the anti-discrimination law that gay rights activists had been working to pass for years passed with broad support once the faith endorsed it. Williams, whose group has been one of the main advocates for the hate crimes law, said he did not know Thursday if the church's statement had changed minds on the proposal. Considered a death blow to the effort by supporters. Utah Senate President Wayne Niederhauser, R. Sandy, acknowledged the church's position would make that measure much more difficult to pass. IRCWR said Thursday that his proposal would protect religious groups, including members of the LDS Church, because Utah's current hate crimes law is too weak to be enforced. Under current Utah law, there's no legal distinction between painting a smiley face on a synagogue or painting a swastika on a synagogue. They're both treated like mere graffiti, IRCWR said. I apologize to the Jewish community and to the state of Utah that legal protections will not be provided against such threats because of a press release by my church, he added. IRCWR quickly left the news conference before taking questions from reporters and disappeared into back rooms of the Capitol. His proposal was approved last week by a Senate committee and is awaiting a vote by the full Senate that is not expected to happen at least until next week. IRCWR's supporters said they'll still push forward with the legislation but acknowledged it may not happen this year. Utah is one of 15 states with hate crime laws that lack protections for sexual orientation and identity, according to the Human Rights Campaign.
And here's another hate crimes case.
San Jose jurors began deliberating Thursday whether three white former San Jose State freshmen committed
battery and a hate crime by hazing their only black suite mate, or if they were merely immature, insensitive, and stupid pranksters. During the two-week misdemeanor trial, Santa Clara County Prosecutor Carolyn Malinsky claimed that Colin Warren and Logan Beechler, now 20, and Joseph Brett Baumgartner, 21, participated to various degrees in subjecting Donald Williams Jr., who was 17, to repeated bullying in fall 2013. The alleged abuse included clamping a U-shaped bike lock around Williams' neck and trying to do so a second time, calling him racially derogatory names, locking him in his room and bathroom, trying to lock him in a closet and displaying a Confederate flag. There was also a plan to put white pieces of paper on every bedroom door besides the one where Williams lived, the prosecutor contended. All three men have pleaded not guilty to the misdemeanor charges, which carry penalties ranging from community service and weekend work up to a year in county jail. When you look at all the acts, everything DJ Williams suffered, what is unreasonable to believe is that this had nothing to do with race, Malinsky contended in closing arguments Thursday. The reasonable explanation is that this happened in part because of race. Advertisement but lawyers for the men told the jury of six men and six women which appeared racially mixed but without an African American that their clients were typical immature, insensitive, and stupid boys in their late teens, and the incidents were just the result of a harmless, innocently intended prank war, not bigotry. They also put on character evidence to try to demonstrate to the jury that their clients are not prejudiced. For instance, an African-American student that Warren was dating at the time of the alleged offenses testified about their five-week relationship. It tells you Colin Warren isn't racist, Warren's lawyer, Deck Ketchum, told the jury about the relationship. He's dating an African-American woman and did not want the relationship to end. All three defendants testified, including Baumgartner, who apologized for his relatively limited involvement. In one particularly notable moment, Beechler testified that he didn't consider the repeated display of a Confederate flag in their suite to be an insensitive symbol of racial supremacy or slavery, just a symbol of small government, conservatism. Malinsky dubbed that ridiculous during her closing argument. Jurors also heard some of the men's coaches, family friends and teachers testify about their good character and lack of prejudice. They were shown photos of some of the defendants with black family friends and teammates, part of the lawyers' seemingly united effort to persuade the jury not to brand the men as racist by convicting them of a hate crime. But Malinsky stressed that the jury doesn't have to believe the men are bigots, merely that they singled out Williams in part because he was the only black student out of the 8 engineering freshmen living in the 4-bedroom suite. She also contended that we are all biased. Good people can do things that are wrong, she said. There's no R, for racism, going on their foreheads. We are all biased.
Talk about delusional young people that are getting so screwed up with this race situation. That is so screwed. These guys say, I'm a conservative. I'm a conservative Republican. I'm not a racist, even though I had the Confederate flag and stuffed the guy in a closet with the Confederate flag and all that stuff. See, of course this stuff is racism. Of course it's racism. But it's amazing, and it's almost funny, the lengths people will go to claim they're not racist. Including having a black girlfriend. How can a guy with a black girlfriend feel he's racist? I mean, I don't understand this. And then also that some of the guys had blacks in their family or something. I'm telling you, it's getting weirder all the time. Very strange.
A 31-year-old man ambushed overnight walking here along Roosevelt Avenue and 81st Street. Three men hurling homosexual slurs in Spanish, then attack.
There's a lot of things that happen around here.
It happens so much. Sometimes I work in the night and it happens.
Juan Morales says Roosevelt Avenue turns into a different place at night when the rift between the gay community and some here who object is more easily exposed.
In the nighttime, everybody, there's a lot of bars. There's a lot of drinking, you know. And I believe that's kind of the alcohol that mess your head.
Eric Herrera has lived here 16 years and is stunned by news of the attack.
That stuff doesn't really happen around here. We're an open neighborhood here.
I have no problem with them. Yeah. You know, they're good guys.
Now, police sources tell me they are considering this a hate crime and have a task force that is investigating it as a bias attack. No arrests have yet been made. As for the victim, he was treated and released with a concussion at a nearby hospital. In Jackson Heights, Queens, I'm John Chandler, News 4 to you.
Now, that was an all-Hispanic area, almost solidly mestizo or whatever you want to call them. So it's the mestizos beating up on the homosexuals. And here's another Negro attack.
DC police are working to identify at least four teens accused of attacking and robbing a decorated... This morning, DC police are working to identify at least four teens accused of attacking and robbing a decorated Marine inside a McDonald's. Let's meet that Marine now. He's Marine Sergeant Chris Marquez. He went to that McDonald's for a meal, but according to him, a group of teens had a different idea. They asked him if he thought, quote, Black Lives Matter. And when he did not respond, they called him a racist. And next thing you know, they attacked him, knocked him unconscious. Sergeant Marquez joins us right now for an exclusive interview. And although he's feeling better from that picture, he still has constant head pain. And Sergeant, you still came on our show. We appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Oh, anytime, Brian. I appreciate you guys inviting me.
Well, you've also earned a Bronze Star for your service in Iraq, and we know about the famous picture from what was taken as you helped a Marine get out of Hell House in that famous battle in Fallujah, you and another. But let's talk about what happened in the hell, which was McDonald's that day in Washington, D.C. You were eating, and then what took place?
Well, I was eating at McDonald's. It was just myself and a group of kids came. I believe it was at least four or five, possibly more. They're all males I know for a fact one of them was a female, possibly two. It's really hard to remember just because as the days go on, my memory is getting a little more worse. And they were just being rowdy inside the McDonald's, and I figured they were just, you know, teens, whatever. And they stopped on my table, and they kind of like, they went around my table in a group, almost like confronted me. And they were asking about the movement, if I thought Black Lives Matter. And I was ignoring them because they were actually just trying to intimidate me. It just seems like they just wanted a confrontation. And I wasn't going to play along with that. I just wanted to eat my food and leave. And then they started calling me a racist. And what I do remember, I believe I told them to leave me alone. And that's when it gets really fuzzy, just because personally, I thought originally I was attacked in the McDonald's. But according, I talked to the manager, and he went through the, he told me what happened through the camera footage. And he said they attacked me as I exited the McDonald's. Wow. And basically, I was out cold. I was hit in the back of the head with something. They're not exactly sure if they had anything in their hand or not, just because of the quality of the footage. But the manager said the moment I got hit, I just fell straight on the ground on the pavement, and I was unconscious. And then that's when they came and they stole everything in my pockets. They tore my pants, trying to take taken with my wallet. And he said like a minute or two later, I woke up and I wandered off. That's when I got into the taxi cab. They took me back to my apartment complex. I told the people in my front lobby. Right. They called the cops for me. The cops came, took me to the hospital in George Washington University.
Couple of things. Number one, I saw that the manager said he thought you got hit in the back of the head with a gun at first.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Yes.
And number two is you lost your consciousness. No one came to help? There was nobody around?
No, sir. And the part that's so funny, because apparently there was a lot of traffic going on at that McDonald's, because when I talked to the police officers, at first they couldn't confirm the actual group, like who it was, because they said there was a lot of people coming in and out of the McDonald's. But then today I got an email from one of the officers. He told me they actually have confirmed it was those people that were harassing me in the McDonald's. And personally, you know, I'm telling this to everybody just because it's been happening a lot around here and across our country. There was a hate crime. They targeted me because of my skin color. And so we're seeing a lot of these events of people being attacked because they're white.
Right.
And I'm thinking we have to speak up more about this because it's just going to continue to happen.
But Sergeant, the ironic thing is, you were just telling me, you fight over in Iraq in some of the toughest fighting America has seen of this generation. And you're fighting with blacks, whites, of all Americans from all faiths, creeds, and colors.
Yes, sir. When you join the military, you serve to protect all Americans, not a particular group. And like I said before, I was there fighting with people from all backgrounds, religions, everything. So you name it, you know. And that was why I found it very ironic, because the person calling me the racist was the actual racist. They have no idea about my background, what I did for this country, or what other people like myself, you know, every day we do for this country.
And, of course, you fought in Fallujah, in Hell House. You went in there because some Marines were stuck, and you got them out. And that famous shot is used as a symbol for wounded warriors from this day on. And it's even a statue talking about that. They didn't know who they attacked. They just saw a white person, in your estimation. But you do want to look for one person, not only the people that attacked you, but the cab driver that drove you home. You want to pay him?
Absolutely. That cab driver basically saved my life. He was a little irritated at first because I didn't have any money to pay him because I just got mugged. But he took me home, and I have no idea who he is, but I want to thank that guy, whoever he is. I want to pay him back. I want to give him a, you know, right now I can't pay him right now because all my ATM cards are canceled. I got to wait till they come back in, and they took my money. But besides that, I really want, you know, that cab driver really helped me out.
Right. And if we hear from that, I'd love to have some closure on that story, and then hopefully we'll apprehend the guys that beat you up. Sergeant Chris Marquez, thanks for your dip for the country. Thanks for getting up this morning and telling your story. And let's stay in touch.
Now, the reason I play some of this stuff back for you is to get you to understand the thinking of white people that are involved in this kind of stuff. Now, even this guy, he didn't say black. They were black. He said teens. See, the people are even intimidated to say what they are. And then, of course, trying to cover up the whole thing by saying, well, I fought in Iraq with the blacks and the Chinamen and the Indians and the Negroes, sort of to dissuade anybody from thinking he might be a little bit pro-white. However, he did say white people are going to have to start responding and reporting to this. They're going to have to start doing more than responding and reporting. They're going to have to kick ass, man. Now, I wonder why he didn't try to fight his way out. Maybe he did. I don't know. But I get very tired of seeing white people delusional that say, oh, I'm not racist, I'm not prejudiced, and stand there and get their ass beat. But that's the only way they will learn, if they will learn at all. Well, now that we've got so many mestizos in this country and other races from all over the place, they're starting to turn on each other. Well, they've been doing it for quite a while. But here's a story of two mestizos beating the crap out of a black homosexual.
ADL welcomes sentencing of two men for federal hate crime against gay African American man. The Anti-Defamation League, ADL, applauds Corpus Christi Police, the FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office of the Southern District of Texas and the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division for the successful prosecution and sentencing of two men who pleaded guilty to a hate crime in connection with their attack on a gay African American man in Corpus Christi. 33-year-old Jimmy Garza and 23-year-old Ramiro Cereda, Jr. each were sentenced to 15 years in federal prison and ordered to pay $10,800 in restitution, serve 3 years of supervised release and register as sex offenders. They pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit hate crimes and violating the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd, Jr. Hate Crime Prevention Act. Garza and Cereda admitted to punching and kicking the victim, and battering him with numerous weapons including a handgun, frying pan, a mug, a sock filled with batteries and a belt. They sodomized the victim with a broom handle and poured bleach onto the victim's face and into his eyes. Senior U.S. District Judge Hayden Head's remarks during the sentencing reflected the horrific nature of the crime. Judge Head said the attackers had abandoned their humanity to the viciousness of animals. He said the punishment should send a message that their behavior won't be tolerated in a civilized society. We applaud investigators, prosecutors, and federal Judge Hayden Head for the prosecution and sentencing of Jimmy Garza and Ramiro Cereda, Jr., and for once again successfully using the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd, Jr. Hate Crime Prevention Act, said ADL Associate Director Dina Marks. U.S. Attorney Ken Magidson and Justice Department prosecutors and their staffs continue to use the federal hate crime law to bring the perpetrators of these heinous crimes to justice, and convey that such crimes will be fully prosecuted and punished, Marks added. We hope their efforts also deter future hate crimes in our region, and across the country. ADL is one of this country's foremost civil rights organizations. ADL drafted the model hate crime law used in 45 states and the District of Columbia and helped secure passage of the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd, Jr. Hate Crime Prevention Act. ADL is working to improve the response to all hate crimes with its number 50 States Against Hate initiative.
Boys and girls, just make sure you only commit love crimes. Hate crimes is a no, no, no. But seriously, don't involve yourselves in this kind of street activity that don't change anything. Doesn't change anything. We got bigger fish to fry. Well, looks like things are heating up a little over in Deutschland. They had that big trial of that terror cell that was around a few years ago. And they've got a trial going on over there. But it's interesting what's happening. Listen to this.
A fifth person connected to an ongoing inquiry into an underground Nazi terror cell has died suddenly, leading one expert to claim that it can't possibly be coincidence. Sasha W. was found dead on February 8 in the southern state of Baden-Württemberg. He was 31 years old, apparently fit and healthy. After conducting a post-mortem, local prosecutors believe it was suicide, reports Heise.de. Saxa W. sent out a suicide note via SMS before his death, and there is no indication that a third party was involved, prosecutors say. But the death has risen to national attention because W is now the fifth person with a connection to a series of grisly murders carried out by a neo-Nazi terror cell to die suddenly. Over the course of a decade starting in 2000, the National Socialist Underground, NSU, are believed to have murdered 10 people, all of them Turkish or Greek immigrants except for policewoman Michelle Kieswetter. The Enquirer is looking whether there was a support network behind the terror cell, and the death of Kieswetter seems to be particularly sensitive. A link of deaths back to Nazi scene. Sasha W. was the fiancé of Melissa M., a 20-year-old who died a month after giving evidence to the terror in inquiry in March 2015. A post-mortem concluded that M. had died from a blood embolism likely caused by a motorbike accident she'd been involved in 2 weeks earlier. M. herself was the ex-girlfriend Florian Heilig, who in September 2013 burned to death in his car hours before he was due to be questioned about the NSU. Subsequent tests also revealed a cocktail of drugs in his bloodstream. Heilig, who had been involved in the local neo-Nazi scene in Heilbronn, was said to know who killed Kieswetter. He wasn't the first witness in the investigation into the policewoman's death to die. In 2009, Arthur C.'s charred corpse was found after he had come up as a line of inquiry in the investigation. In April 2014, 39-year-old Thomas Richter died in his apartment, allegedly from a sugar imbalance caused by undiagnosed diabetes. Richter was also believed to have background information about the murder of Michelle Kieswetter. Story continues below. Hajo Funk, professor of politics at the Free University in Berlin, told Berlin's Tageszeitung, TAZ, "So many suicides. Something isn't right. There's a pattern there. There are people who had a connection to Melissa M. who are terrified about a scene of neo-Nazis and organized crime. Their fear isn't without reason," said Funk, who has written a book on the NSU. Funk called on the state to do more to protect potential witnesses. They need to do their job. The Interior Ministry need to put more pressure on local law enforcement. How many more people will die before something happens?
Well, it seems like people who have crossed the National Socialists in Germany are having a little problem. Wow. Well, let's take a few minutes and go back to Skokie, Illinois, and the infamous Nazi march in Skokie.
Skokie, Illinois. It's just outside Chicago. And this is where I grew up. I could tell there were things about my dad that were different.
I would ask my dad, why I don't have any grandparents? Why don't I have any aunts or uncles? Why don't I have any cousins?
The older I got, the more I realized there were secrets in our family. And discovering those secrets became almost like an obsession to me.
My name is Frank Collin. I am the party leader of the National Socialist Party of America.
Death to the Nazis! Death!
25 or 30 members of a ragtag Nazi party in Chicago want to parade through Skokie.
And something started to happen in Skokie. I didn't know it at the time, but my father's past was right in the middle.
My children were unaware. They had no any detail of my being, you know, in the concentration camp. I was very sick, very weak. When I was liberated, I weighed about 65 pounds.
I never in my wildest dream could I have imagined to come back, especially with my son.
I'm okay.
It is almost unimaginable that a survivor who has gone through the experience of the Holocaust can find a safe place and suddenly have the word Nazi uttered in their midst, right down their streets. Unimaginable.
The nightmares were always there, but if there was a touch, smell, a word, anything would bring it back.
I think I now understand what this means to Dad, to be able to confront the secrets that refuse to fade away.
Well, one of those secrets was, the big secret was, that the leader of the Nazi Party, Frank Collin, was really Frank Cohen, the Jew, later to become imprisoned for being a pedophile. And he's still around. How about that? So there's a couple of good shots in here in color of the guys in Chicago. I'll send this whole thing along to you. And I may put this into audio, but no. Oh, no, I'll just send the whole thing to you and you can check it out. Well, that's it for today, boys and girls. I sent a letter off to that newspaper that had that Skokie article and asked them, how come after all these years it's never been exposed that Frank Collin was Frank Cohen, a Jew? Inquiring minds would like to know. We'll see if I get a letter back. I'll see you tomorrow. Wait, this is Freya's Day. I'll see you Moonsday. Have a good weekend.
Breaker 19, this here's a rubber duck. You got a copy on me, Big Ben? Come on. Yeah, 10-4, Big Ben, for sure, for sure. By golly, it's clean, clear to Flagtown. Come on. Yeah, it's a big 10-4 there, Big Ben. Yeah, we definitely got the front door, good buddy. Mercy sakes alive, looks like we got us a convoy.
It was the dark of the moon on the 6th of June in a Kenworth pulling logs. Cab over Pete with a reefer on and a Jimmy hauling hogs. We is heading for Bear on I-10 about a mile out of Shaky Town. I says, Pigpen, this here's a rubber duck and I'm about to put the hammer down.
Cause we got a little convoy rocking through the night. Yeah, we got a little convoy, ain't she a beautiful sight? Come on and join our convoy, ain't nothing gonna get in our way. We gonna roll this truckin' convoy across the USA. Convoy.
Got a breaker, Big Ben, this here's a duck. Now, you want to back off them hogs? 10-4, about 5 miles or so. 10, roger, them hogs is getting intense up here.
By the time we got into Tulsa Town, we had 85 trucks in all. But they's a roadblock up on the Cloverleaf, and them bears was wall to wall. Yeah, them Smokies as thick as bugs on a bumper. They even had a bear in the air. I says, calling all trucks, this here's the duck. We about to go a hunting bear.
Cause we got a great big convoy rocking through the night. Yeah, we got a great big convoy. Ain't she a beautiful sight? Come on and join our convoy. Ain't never gonna get in our way. We gonna roll this tucking convoy across the USA. Convoy.
You wanna give me a 10-9 on that, Big Ben? Negatory, Big Ben. You're still too close. Yeah, them hulk is starting to close up my sinuses. Mercy sakes, you better back off another 10.
Well, we rolled up Interstate 44 like a rocket sled on rails. We tore up all of our swindle sheets and left them sitting on the scales. By the time we hit that shy town, them bears was getting smart. They'd brought up some reinforcements from the Illinois National Guard. There's armored cars, tanks, jeeps, and rigs of every size. Yeah, them chicken coops was full of bears, and choppers filled the skies. Well, we shot the line, we went for broke, with 1,000 screaming trucks, and 11 long-haired friends of Jesus in a chartreuse microbus.
Yeah, rubber duck to Sodbuster. Come on here, yeah. 10-4, Sodbuster. Listen, you want to put that microbus in behind that suicide jockey? Yeah, he's hauling dynamite, and he needs all the help he can get.
Well, we laid a strip for the Jersey Shore and prepared to cross the line. I could see the bridge was lined with bears, but it didn't have a doggone dime. I says, Pigpen, this here's a rubber duck. We just ain't gonna pay no toll. So we crashed the gate doing 98. I says, let them truckers roll 10-4.
Cause we got a mighty 10-4.